You're listening to What Goes On Here, and I'm Sam Walker. Whoever we are, and whatever we do, we all have moments when we feel like we don't quite fit with the world around us. What Goes On Here is where you can listen to real stories of people who at times couldn't see a way forward, people who found themselves stuck, maybe in a life they never imagined would be theirs, people who had to face their fears, face themselves, but they changed, and changed lives of people around them too. This is Season 2, Episode 3, Kevin. Kevin Sherd's an author. He's also a writer, a speaker, and co-founder of the Do Right Foundation, which aims to educate and empower young people.
It's hard to get a kid to listen to you, especially kids that have been disappointed most of their lives. So when they hear stuff, they might not take it all in. But if you show them, you have a better chance of being successful.
He's also an ex-drug dealer and a violent criminal who served more than 12 years in prison.
I'm dealing poison in the streets. I'm dealing a substance that's highly addictive, and it's causing people to commit crime. So it's causing people to go out and steal. It's causing people to go out and rob and take things from their family just to get the money or the funds.
Despite a horrendous upbringing on the violent streets of Baltimore, which inspired the hit drama The Wire, Kevin asserts it was choice, not necessity, that kept him returning to crime.
Along that whole journey, I could have done something different every single time. I didn't have to do any of that. Like, I never had to do any. I could have walked away, but I decided not to.
When you've spent your whole life making bad decisions, how do you start making the right ones? How do you forgive yourself for the mistakes that you've made?
And that's what set me free. Because prior to that, I was mad with the world. And I continued to make bad decisions and bad choices based on my false belief that I've been wronged by the world.
How old were you when you first saw a crime being committed?
A crime or a violent crime? Because I think I probably saw a crime being committed probably like 15 years old.
Yeah.
14 maybe. I saw my first murder being committed when I was about close to 17 years old in a club in Baltimore. A guy was, the music was playing and it was in the dark and people were enjoying the night. And so it was a friend of mine. We were tall kids. So we could sneak into these clubs. We played basketball, so we could sneak into these clubs. And we got into the club, and we had done it probably about four or five times up until this point. And in the middle of the night and in the dark, a guy shot a guy in the chest. And we ran, and everybody was a stampede, and people were terrified, and people were running. And we ended up running past the dead body, and I remember looking down and seeing literally a hole in this guy's chest. And I was only a young teenager at that time, and that was the beginning of just seeing a lot of crazy stuff in my life.
See, a lot of people, having witnessed something as horrific as that at such a vulnerable age, 16-year-old boy, would go, oh, that is a life I want nothing to do with ever again. But it wasn't for you. As you said, it was the start of being ensconced in that life for you.
It was, and that was the beginning. And it was like we created this, we built up this kind of, I call it wearing the mask. So when you see the pain and it starts to not bother you, you become numb to it over a period of time. And you become more numb and more numb. And after a while, you don't even feel it anymore. And I think that's kind of what happened to me in the streets. I just saw so much stuff, and I just became numb. It's almost like a soldier on the battlefield. Like, you're going to see a lot of ugly stuff, but you can't stop. You got to keep going forward. And so you just block it out.
So it wasn't that the life really attracted you. It wasn't that you thought, hey, look at these drug dealers, look at these gangsters. I'd love to be part of that world. It wasn't that yearning to be part. It was more you couldn't see any other way to go.
Right. So we grew up in poverty. I grew up in a tough situation, substance abuse and father, poverty. And so I was more attracted to the money. You know, not the other stuff. But I didn't realize that the other stuff came along with the package. Like, it's a package deal. You get them both. You get the money and you get all the craziness all together. And so I started, you know, realizing that, okay, so, I'm enjoying the money, but I'll take the crazy stuff. I prefer not to have it, but I'll take it. But then it just got more and more and more and more unbearable. And, you know, it just, you know, like I said, you become numb after a while.
In all of this, what was crazy is that at 18 years old, you did try. You did try and leave the world that you'd just entered. You tried to become a cop.
Right. And I was that. And so many people just don't know about that story. But yeah, I tried to go join the Baltimore police force. And as you read in the book, I got rejected. But that was an opportunity for me to be saved right there.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of slipped through the fingers of authorities at that time. And I just ended up back into this crazy world. And that was around the time that I first was introduced to dealing heroin. And that was a little after that, I saw this, I went into this crazy world of just the peak of the heroin trade in Baltimore City.
I mean, the book, your book, Lessons of Redemption, I mean, it's a visceral read. You know, the things that you witnessed, overdoses that you saw and actually, I guess, caused, because when you started out in the heroin trade, you were selling, you didn't know what you were doing. And, it seems, trying to kind of talk about it, you're like, oh, I didn't know what I was doing, so I cut it up all wrong. And people came to you because you were selling pure heroin, which no one else on the streets was. And you kind of stumbled into becoming the most desirable dealer there.
That's a crazy story.
Yeah.
I had no idea what heroin was. And me and this guy, we packaged it and we started selling it, and it almost killed some people. And that's what I mean about how crazy, and that's what young people have to understand, how crazy that world is, because we started selling it and almost killed somebody. Mm. Instead of people running away from it, more people ran towards it.
Another
bizarre part of that entire world. And that's why I felt like I have to make sure that this story reaches the rest of the world, because there's such a big misconception about dealing drugs.
Explain that.
The glamorous part, you know, people, you know, you watch television, you see the fast cars and the jewelry and the nice clothes and the nice homes. And I think a lot of people miss the part that a lot of guys dealing drugs are miserable. Right. And I guarantee you, 99.9% of the guys, if you could give them something else to do where they could make the same money or close, they definitely would. Because I haven't met a guy that likes to be shot at.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a scary thing. You know, I haven't met guys that love going to prison. You know, that's another issue. So, you know, given the opportunity, I think a lot of guys would do something different, but I think people have to understand it's not as pretty as it claims to be.
There's a very vivid description in the book of when you beat somebody up, a guy called Terry.
Right.
And you kind of write about it very dispassionately, and you say, I needed to do this. I had to set an example, because the whole block's looking on for the next genius who thought he could get away with double-crossing you. I mean, going and beating somebody up, most of us have never done that. And most of us, thank goodness, will never have to do that. But I can't imagine going in and knowing you've got to physically really hurt somebody because it's them or you. I mean, what's it like being in that moment?
It's a tough situation to be in. I think much of the violence that takes place in the streets comes from a place where a guy is afraid that if he doesn't act, then he's going to become a victim himself, right? And that situation is perpetuated so much and so often on a daily basis that that's just part of the life. And I think many of the people in that space are walking on eggshells. But you have to wear the mask. So it looks like you're a tough guy. It looks like you're a guy that's handling his business. It looks like a guy that just would destroy anything in his path. But from my experience, that's a lot of times that's just not the case. It's a guy wearing a mask, afraid, and he has to set an example because he doesn't want to become an example.
But then you've got society looking in, and as you've described it, there you are, you're living on eggshells, you're living in constant fear, you can't ever relax, your life's hell, but society looking in go, look at this tough guy ruining lives, getting people into drugs, destroying families.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, once you put yourself in a situation, then I guess you're open to all kinds of scrutiny and all kinds of labels, but the reality is much different than, you know, what people think it is. And I've seen so many guys meet their demise because they're trying to live up to that standard or live or just survive in that space. Like, I've seen so many guys killed or gone to prison for life, you know, because they had to, you know, they went and killed the guy because they were afraid that the guy was going to kill them first. Like I said, that whole world is just a bizarre, like, place to be in.
How did your mother react to this choice you made about the way you lived your life? Because, I mean, you were church going. Your mother worked really hard to keep you from literally starving. Sometimes food wasn't around. I mean, water was shut off in the house all the time. She couldn't pay the bill. She raised you to be a good person. How did she deal with the fact you'd gone down this road?
Oh, she definitely wasn't happy. She definitely wasn't happy. But by 16, 17 years old, my father was gone. I had two other sisters and one other brother. So it was four of us. She was working, you know, two jobs during the day and a weekend job. So a young, you know, strong-willed kid determined to do something, it was just hard for her to keep, you know, track of me. And my mind was already made up that I was going to do, you know, what I wanted to do, and I was going to find out the hard way. And I always think about, you know, where the kid that's raised in a single parent household, that other parent plays a much bigger role than a lot of people may even realize, because just being around isn't a deterrent from the kid doing something crazy or doing something foolish. And so if my father was around, I think it would have had an impact, but he wasn't, and I gravitated towards the streets, and the streets became family, and which is never a good thing.
You saw firsthand during this time what crime did to people around you. Obviously, as you said, you saw the murders, the beatings up, the stabbings, the overdosing. And yet when your girlfriend was mugged, your pregnant girlfriend, you were devastated. And you said, you know, to see someone you love in distress because of the impact of crime was unbearable. I mean, there's a great irony in that, isn't there? You're out...
Yeah.
You're out destroying people's lives. And yet when it happens to you, did a light go on at that point? Did you realize?
No, you know what? The light didn't go on because I couldn't put all the pieces together at that age and at that time. The light didn't go on until later on. Mm. But looking back, like you said, look how ironic that was. I'm dealing poison in the streets. Mm. I'm dealing... A substance that's highly addictive, and it's causing people to commit crime. So it's causing people to go out and steal. It's causing people to go out and rob and take things from their family just to get the money or the funds to get the drugs. But now I become a victim, or my family becomes a victim of the same crazy scenario that I'm perpetuating myself, dealing drugs. And and I think it wasn't really till later on that my mother got mugged by a crack addict. And when I was in a prison in California, and I felt so helpless because there wasn't nothing I could do, that's a few years later, that's when the light bulb went on. And I said, you know what? I'm playing a role in this myself.
Yeah.
And that's the other part that I just think the world has to understand about this whole business of drugs. It's a cycle of destruction.
I want to get on to then the beginning of the change in your life. Your past eventually caught up with you, and you'd been living on the edge for, you know, a decade. You'd started to try and go legit. You'd actually, and a lot of people might be really surprised having learned about what you'd just been through, you decided to become a florist, Kevin. Of course you did. You started for floristry. But there was so much evidence against you for the past that despite the fact, you know, you were killer at arranging a bouquet, the cops came for you. You decided to plead guilty. You went to prison. You'd just become a father. How tough was that to walk away from your baby?
Oh, that was hard. Up until that point in my life, that was the hardest, like, thing that I had to do. Because up until that, like I said, you're numb. So you're just blocking stuff out. You're blocking, you know, friends being killed. You're blocking out, you know, friends going to prison. You're blocking out a bunch of stuff. But I couldn't block out my daughter. You know what I mean? And so that was really, like, really, really tough. But I kind of, looking back, that was actually, for me, the change internally, the change in my heart started with my daughter.
Tell me about prison. You'd been trapped in a lifestyle you couldn't escape from for years, but what was it like being physically trapped?
It was tough from the standpoint, the mental part of it, being confined and being controlled and being told what to do and when to do it and being away from family. That was really tough. As far as the environment, just being around a bunch of guys, you know, every day, all day, that wasn't as hard because most of those guys were guys from the streets. So, you know, I have this belief that if you can survive the streets, you can survive prison because they're the same characters. The sociopaths, the psychopaths, you know, as well as like everybody else in between. But it's the confinement that takes a hold of you, being confined to those small spaces, confined to cells. That's just not normal for a human being to be locked away from loved ones and confined that way. That's just not normal.
What's it do to you mentally?
It takes a toll on you. You become depressed for sure, but you don't even realize you're depressed. And that's where a lot of guys act out in the violence in prison. You know, a guy might want to kill you because you changed the television channel. Well, he really doesn't want to kill you because you changed the television channel. He's probably in a deep, deep depression and probably needs some medication. But you don't understand those things when you're locked up. Anger is your tool of trade when you're incarcerated. You're angry at the government, you're angry at the police, you're angry at, you know, the other inmates, you're angry at your girlfriend, you're angry at everybody.
What about being angry at yourself? Because it was you who put yourself in there.
Right. And so when you can come to terms with that, that's when things start to change. Because for me, that's when I was able to take responsibility for my own actions and say, wait a minute, you got you here. Then that's when my mindset started to change and my whole thinking process started to change.
You start to talk about, you talked about lights going on and attitude changing, because the first time you're in prison, you're actually making plans to expand your drug business whilst inside. You get out, you set up a deal with this man, Jesus. It turns out he's working with the DEA. Guess what? You get busted immediately. You're straight back inside, and it's this time there's you decide to use your time differently and you start a college degree.
Right.
You start doing yoga, which is amazing.
And, oh, that's funny.
And then, I mean, there's a great line, really great line, at the end of chapter 10, where a light goes on and you said, the bottom line was, I was never coerced into selling drugs. I made a conscious decision to get involved in something I knew was wrong from the very beginning. At some point, I had to take responsibility for my actions.
Right. Exactly. And that's what set me free. Because prior to that, I was mad with the world. And I continued to make bad decisions and bad choices based on my false belief that I've been wronged by the world. Mm. And so when I started taking responsibility, now I'm making better decisions because I'm better understanding the consequences. You're in control of your life for the most part. You're in control of many of the good things that happen to you as well as many of the bad things that happen to you. And when I got into that mindset, like that's when my life started to evolve.
I mean, throughout the book, you use the word choices, and you drop this word in at key moments. And I'm thinking of, you know, the time when you walked into the police station and tried to register to become a cop. There was a chance there for you to be saved almost. When Anthony, the man who was so close to you, when he was killed, there was a chance for you to go, what am I doing? Walk away. There's, you know, you were nearly shot in a parking lot in McDonald's. Two rival drug gang members came to come and kill you. And a lot of people would go, that's the point again. I'm going to walk away. And at no point when there was these big, almost flag-waving signals from the universe, Kevin, walk away!
Yeah.
you chose not to.
Right. Along that whole journey, I could have done something different every single time, even with Jesus. Mm. So he was an undercover DEA. I went to Mexico, and we set up these deals to bring cocaine to the States. I didn't have to do any of that.
Yeah.
Like I never had to do any. I could have walked away. I could have tore up Jesus's phone number when I walked out of prison that time, but I decided not to. And I just feel like life is about choices, and that's the conversation that I have with the young people when I speak at colleges and universities. And you have a lot more power over your life than you realize, right? And a lot of it is based on the choices that you make, the good ones and the bad ones. All throughout life, you know, relationships, what choice I want to, what religion I decide to take, what food I decide to eat, what type of drink I decide to put into my body, or, what type of person I decide to date and bring into my life, you know, what school I decide to, what... You have so much power over your life, and we just don't realize. And it took me sitting in prison for almost 12 years, you know, locked away in a cell to really come to terms with that.
When you have that moment where you realize that you are the master of your own life and the choices you make are who makes the man that you are, you talk about the mask numbing you from the pain of realizing what you've done. When you take that mask off, how painful is it?
I think when you take the mask off, it actually becomes liberating because you don't have to live up to this facade anymore. Like you don't have to live up to being the most dangerous drug dealer from West Baltimore, or you don't have to live up, from bringing, the guy that's, importing heroin from overseas. You don't have to live up to that anymore. Now you can just be you. And now you can just start enjoying life again. It's crazy because even today I'll run into people I knew from those years and they'll spend a little time around me and some of them will say, you're not the same guy you used to be. And some of them will hate being around me because
really?
I'm definitely not the guy that I used to be. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
Are the moments when you were going through this process, though, that you saw the enormity of the choices that you had made in your past? And there was one line you talked about, the fact that, you didn't get married, you didn't get a regular job, and it's almost like you couldn't believe you'd let these pass you by.
Right, right. You look back and you're like, wow, I actually did that? And that was, like, really, really eye-opening because at that point, now I'm around normal people.
Yeah.
So I'm around normal people that graduated college, got married, had a baby, had a second baby, and now they bought a house, and that, and they have a fa- like, I missed all the many of these processes.
You feel
like
sad.
Yeah, because you look back and you're like, wow, I missed. You missed normal life. Like, because I was in that business for so long, I thought that was normal. So if you didn't sell drugs, something was wrong with you. Or you didn't like dating guys that sold dope, something was wrong with you. Or you didn't like taking a vacation and spending $20,000. No, in real life, that's dumb. Like $20,000, that's a down payment on a house. Or it's a down payment on a lot of things for a family or college education. Like, this is the normal stuff. So when I found out what normal was, I looked back and was like, wow, I was a fool. I thought that was, you know, great stuff. And so now I felt like I was trying to catch up. Like I missed out on so much stuff. So now I just want to be normal again.
Do you have compassion for that man you used to be? Do you have empathy with him?
Yeah, I do. Because he got lost. You know what I mean? Like that man got lost. Or that kid got lost. And so when I see kids going down the same path that I was going down, I see myself in a lot of them. Mm. And I had to come to terms with, don't get caught up in trying to save every single kid, because you can't. But you can save a few. You can talk to a few. And maybe you'll talk a few out of going down that path. Because every single kid I see that's in that situation, trying to make that choice, do I go to the streets or do I go to college? You know, do I carry a gun or do I carry notebooks? So I visited a prison for juveniles in the Virgin Islands. And all these kids came out that were locked up for, you know, stealing cars and, you know, and little packages of drugs. And that was my first time back inside of a prison since I left. And
how did that feel?
It was hard. It was hard. It took me a couple minutes to get relaxed and normal. Because walking in, hearing the doors slam and, you know, and I started reliving this stuff. But then when I saw the kids, I snapped out of it because I was happy to be around the youth because I really enjoy being around young people. And we had a serious conversation. And I said, look, I came to the Virgin Islands to see the beaches and the white sands and the blue sky. And now I'm in a prison sitting in with you guys. You have an opportunity to enjoy life in ways that many people would love to. Like, I would love to live in the Virgin Islands.
Yeah.
Like, and you're in prison. And I was like, you got to make better choices. And you have an opportunity to do something different with your life now. You might be in a tough spot now, but a couple months from now, a couple weeks from now, you'll be back out. What you going to do with that opportunity? And so we talked for about an hour. But I realized that I have to be careful myself because I want to save them all. And it's just not possible. And that's just not a good space to be in. Do what you can. Do more than what you can, but don't try to become a savior, because you only disappoint yourself.
If you had met you when you were 18 years old, do you think your life would have changed? Would you have listened to that advice about choices?
You know, I'm not sure, because I was so strong-headed at the time. I thought I knew it all. So I may not have listened, right? Mm. But if I had somebody to show me, that may be different. And that's what we got to understand about these kids. It's hard to get a kid to listen to you, especially kids that have been disappointed most of their lives by people close to them, their father, their mother. You know, they've been disappointed their entire lives. So when they hear stuff, they might not take it all in. But if you show them, you have a better chance of being successful. And so now for me, I try to live in a way that is a person of remorse, a person of redemption, a person sorry for the past, but also a person that wants to do good in the world. Mm-hmm. I'll show you, not talk about it, because they've been disappointed so much. So if someone came along and actually grabbed me and said, come on, kid, I'm going to show you, you know, another way, I might have taken it.
It's that difficulty, isn't it? How do you get a young person to plan for the future when they don't think they have a future?
Right. And so in Baltimore, not just in Baltimore, but they're young people all across the United States, probably all over the world. They don't see a future for themselves. Their friend, you know, next to them, he just got shot, or he just went to prison, or he just failed, or he's not successful. So they don't see a way out. And so I call it the I'm next syndrome, because I remember going through the I'm next syndrome. So at 22, 23 years old, I wasn't living for 33 or 43 or 53. I was living for 23 and a half. I could only see 6 months ahead, if that, because everybody around me was dying, being shot, going to prison. Even some friends I knew died of it, and attracted HIV and then AIDS and died. So everybody around me was, you know, not in a good space in life. They weren't living long. So they're not just feeling like they don't have a future. It's actually happening in front of their very eyes. And that's a part that we got to work hard to change throughout all society.
We all make mistakes. Every single person listening to this, we all make mistakes. All of us, we fail. But the stories we tell ourselves about the person that we are often the hardest ones to shake off. How do you do that?
Just believe. There's something better out there for you. Believe that the power is within you to change and do better. Just the power of belief and the power, I guess, faith. I always thought, even in prison, that something greater was there for me. I didn't know what it would be. You know, I never sat in prison and planned on writing a book and traveling the world and talking to young people. Like, that was just something that just happened, but I made myself available for good opportunities. Mm. And when I say make myself available, my head was clear. I was more accepting of the truth. I was more accepting of taking responsibility for my poor choices. I was more receptive of meeting good people that could help me grow and that I could learn from. You just got to make yourself mentally available. And when you make yourself mentally available, good things happen.
And when you have gone down a path and made mistakes in your life, how can you shake off being defined by those mistakes?
Do good work. Don't talk about it. Show people. Words don't matter as much as your actions. I've been working in human services now, just doing, you know, low income taxes for people in my old neighborhood. And then I started working with ex-offenders, guys being released from prison, to help them find jobs. And then I started doing drug prevention with young people, which that work actually took me to the White House for an event with the Obama administration. And so, just do the deeds, do the good work, and it'll speak for itself.
Kevin Sherd was talking to me, Sam Walker. You've been listening to What Goes On Here. Coming up next on Season 2, Episode 4, Jacko.
I was just in the best place in my life, really. And all of a sudden, it literally goes from the one day you're on top of the world and you're doing a job you love to the next day where you can't even feed yourself. I was 23. I got blown up on my birthday.